As we begin, I want to express my appreciation to you and to the elders specifically for inviting me to come be with you these last few days. I've been very encouraged by being with you. Doesn't the Lord know what He's doing when He designed church? He designed assemblies, opportunities for Christians to enjoy being together, to remind each other of what's most important, to study together and encourage each other. And so as we've done that, I've been uplifted and I've been encouraged by these opportunities. And I sincerely appreciate your inviting me to come be with you. This evening, I've got an exciting and very encouraging story for you. It's a story about faith, a story about courage. It's one of those good Old Testament stories with a battle in the middle of it. And it's a story about a young man that we don't often think of. When you think of heroes of faith, a lot of names come to mind. And maybe Jonathan is not at the top of that list. But Jonathan is a great character study. He's just a very encouraging young man to study about. It's sad in a way because you can't help but feel sorry for him. His fate is intertwined with his father's fate. Instead of the throne passing down from Saul to Jonathan, there's going to be a change because Saul was a failure as a king. But you don't ever get the sense when you read about Jonathan that he felt sorry for himself. In fact, he pours himself completely in support of David and is just a great friend to David. And even though, in one sense, Jonathan's, story ends on a sad note as he's wrapped up there with his father and his father's defeat. But as we look at Jonathan as a person and in his individual choices, and specifically in today's story, I think we see somebody who was a hero of faith and really chose to make a difference. And so I'm excited to look at this story and review it with you. And we'll be in the book of 1 Samuel. His story is in chapter 14. We're going to start in chapter 8 just to kind of set the stage and remind us of what's going on when we find this moment when really Jonathan steps into the forefront in a great moment of faith. To get there, we're going to start in 1 Samuel 8. And this story, indeed most of the stories of the Bible involving Israel, take place in a time when faith was rare. Back in 1 Samuel 8, the people came to Samuel, you'll recall, and they demanded a king. Now, this displeased both Samuel and God. But remember, God told Samuel, don't worry, they haven't rejected you. They have rejected me as being king over them in verse 7. But Samuel warned the people, this is not a good idea. God told them, this is not a good idea. But look at their reasoning in verses 19 through 20 of 1 Samuel chapter 8. The people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, and they said, no, but there shall be a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. They wanted a king to judge them. They wanted a king to lead them into battle. And asking this statement shows a complete lack of faith on the part of the people. And really, really what comes crystal clear in this story as we get further into it is a contrast between there being basically zero faith on the part of the people in comparison to the faith that we're going to find on Jonathan's part. Now, the reason why this was a complete lack of faith to say we want a king to go before us into battle is because why? The people already had such a king, didn't they? They had this in God himself. Remember what God had said to them back in Deuteronomy when he promised when they went into the land and they were going to face enemies and they were going to face battles. Notice what God said to them, the instructions he gave them. When you go to war against your enemies and see horses and chariots and an army larger than your own, you shall not be afraid of them. For the Lord your God is with you, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. And when you draw near to the battle, the priest shall come forward and speak to the people and shall say to them, hear, O Israel, today you are drawing near for battle against your enemies. Let not your heart be faint. Do not fear or panic or be in dread of them, for the Lord your God is he who goes with you to fight for you against your enemies, to give you the victory. And they say, yeah, but we want a king. We want somebody that's going to lead us. And look at what the promise that they had. But could they see God in this sense with their physical eye? They couldn't. This was to believe in this promise and to trust that God would be with them when they went into battle and give them the victory required faith. At its very essence, that's what faith is. Even though they could not see God when they were going to battle against their enemies, to believe that He is there and to believe that He would be with them is basically the definition of faith. And they've got zero of that. So what they want is, they want something besides this promise. They want something that they can look at. They want a person who's going to be out there in front of them on his horse, leading them into battle, someone that they can see. And that's what people look for when they don't have faith. They look for something concrete that they can see. And so in a sense, God gives them what they ask for. In fact, King Saul seems to be the perfect man for the job. When you look at 1 Samuel chapter 9, verse 1, beginning, there was a man of Benjamin whose name was Kish, the son of Abiel, the son of Zeror, the son of Becherath, son of Aphia, a Benjaminite, a man of wealth. And he had a son whose name was Saul, a handsome young man. There was not a man among the people of Israel more handsome than he. From his shoulders upward, he was taller than any of the people. This is your basic storybook Prince Charming, isn't it? I mean, if you could sort of paint the Disney picture of the valiant prince, here's the guy. He's the best looking person in the whole nation, and he's bigger than everybody else. He's just the natural choice for the job if you're defining things by man's ideas, right? So if you're defining this in terms of physical characteristics, what we can see with our eyes of flesh, here's the person you're looking for. But of course, you remember on the very day that he was anointed king, they couldn't find him. Turn over to chapter 10. Things are not always what they seem. Saul isn't necessarily going to be the kind of leader. You get a kind of a preview of that. In verse 22, they inquired again of the Lord, is there a man still to come? And the Lord said, behold, he's hidden himself among the baggage. And they ran and they took him from there. And when he stood up among the people, he was taller than any of the people from his shoulders upward. And Samuel said to all the people, do you see him whom the Lord has chosen? There is none like him among all the people. And the people shouted, long live the king. I just wonder, as Samuel said that, if there was any irony in his voice as he was saying, do you see the man? Here he is. This is who God has chosen. There's nobody like him. And everybody's all excited. Samuel knows this is not going to go well. He warned the people this is a bad choice. But Saul is the leader that had been given to them. Now, I believe Saul, like all of us, had the opportunity to be faithful himself. And he had moments. If you were to study Saul's personal history, you'd see there were times when he did the right thing. But by and large, if you look at his character, it was deeply flawed with a lack of faith himself. In fact, when it really mattered the most, he was very small on the inside. He might have been larger than everybody else on the outside, but he was a small man. When it came to leading the people, he was more worried about what people thought about him. He was worried about a lot of things except for following God and trusting in God. To see that, just picture in your mind the occasion of David and Goliath. And just picture the image in that moment when Saul is fitting his own armor on the young David and it's way too big for him. And David's the only man in the camp of Israel who had enough faith to say, hey, this man's challenging God and we're not going to let him do that. And Saul is okay with this plan to give this young man his armor. It never occurs to Saul that he should be the one. In fact, what did the people say? We want a king who will go into battle. Goliath was bigger than everybody else. Who is the natural choice of a person to go out and address that threat? The biggest man in the army, the biggest man in Israel, the biggest man on their side, their king, the one they asked for to lead them, is the one who's now gladly giving his sword and shield and things to this young man who's the only one who's got enough faith to go face the giant, the threat against him. And so that just gives you a sense, really in a nutshell, of the weakness of the character of Saul. And so what would you expect the army would be like and the people would be like following Saul's leadership? If that's the kind of guy who's at the forefront, who's really very weak in his faith and doesn't really trust in God, what would you expect the people to be like? And we find out in chapter 13 as we get a little closer to our lesson today. In chapter 13, beginning in verse 1, there's a kind of strange wording here about the number of years, some kind of question about, you may have a note in your Bible about the text itself, but it's not important for our study. Saul lived for 1 year and became king, and when he had reigned for 2 years over Israel, however that's worded, Saul chose 3,000 men of Israel. 2,000 were with Saul in Michmash in the hill country of Bethel, and 1,000 were with Jonathan in Gibeah of Benjamin, the rest of the people he sent home, every man to his tent. So, as the story begins, Saul has a standing army, is what it boils down to. He's selected these men. He's got 2,000. Jonathan, his right-hand man, has 1,000. And that's the arrangement here. Now, what Saul's intention was for his army of 3,000 people, we don't know. It seems like, as we continue reading, that Saul really maybe had him in mind for just defense, but to hunker down, to kind of hang out. Jonathan, on the other hand, has been given 1,000 men, and apparently he thinks the only thing to do is to go to war against the enemy, because that's what he does next. Verse 3, Jonathan defeated the garrison of the Philistines that was at Geba, and the Philistines heard of it. And Saul blew the trumpet throughout all the land, saying, "Let the Hebrews hear." And all Israel heard it, said that Saul had defeated the garrison of the Philistines, and also that Israel had become a stench to the Philistines. And the people were called out to join Saul at Gilgal. So the people think, hey, this is working out. Our leader that we asked for, that we chose, he's leading us into battle. We're going to be victorious. They think that it's Saul. It was Jonathan who led this charge. But they're excited because they think that Saul has won. And so they come out, but not only do the people of Israel show up, the Philistines show up. It's as if you kick over the little fire ant mound while you're mowing or something, and they just sort of, the ground gets covered with them. Notice what we see, verse 5. The Philistines mustered to fight with Israel 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, troops like the sand on the seashore in multitude. They came up and encamped at Michmash to the east of Beth-Aven. When the people of Israel saw they were in trouble, for the people were hard-pressed, the people hid themselves in caves and in holes, in rocks, in tombs, in cisterns. And some Hebrews crossed the fords of the Jordan to the land of Gad and Gilead. Saul was still at Gilgal, and all the people followed him trembling. Hiding in caves and holes in the ground, defecting across the Jordan. This is basically complete surrender. I mean, it's just absolute giving up. That the enemy showed up, and now they're going to run for their lives and hide anywhere they can, in a coffin, anywhere they can find to hide. They're hiding. So hopefully nobody will find them. And they're trembling as they follow Saul. Of course, that Saul's not inspiring any kind of confidence in the people. This reminds me of going to the dog park with my sister when we went to visit her. And she had a little dog, and his name is Tiger, and he's kind of feisty, but he's small. And there were some other dogs there, and he saw a dog, and he went over to that dog. And at first, that dog kind of shied away from him because he was barking and acting big. But then the dog, I guess, realized he was, two or three times the size of Tiger, and so he turned and came at him. Next thing you know, Tiger's running as fast as he can with his tail between his legs. He started out feeling kind of big, but as soon as that other dog decided to face him, he didn't want any part of that. And that almost seems like here what happened. There was a little victory. All of Israel's like, yes, we're winning. And they show up and they see the Philistines, and now they're hiding and running and diving for every kind of cover they can find. It's embarrassing. These are God's people. If they had put their faith in God, they couldn't lose. But, of course, they're not putting their faith in God. And, in fact, look how bad it is in verses 19 through 22. Now, there was no blacksmith to be found throughout all the land of Israel, for the Philistines said, "Lest the Hebrews make for themselves swords or spears." But every one of the Israelites went down to the Philistines to sharpen his plowshare, his mattock, his axe, his sickle. And the charge was 2/3 of a shekel for the plowshares, and for the mattocks, 2/3 of a shekel for sharpening the axes and setting the goads. So on the day of the battle, there was neither sword nor spear found in the hand of any of the people with Saul and Jonathan, but Saul and Jonathan, his son, had them. So here's the picture. After they ran and hid themselves, the Philistines are kind of have run of the land, and they've made sure that if a Israelite wants his plow sharpened, he's got to go ask permission from the Philistine blacksmith and pay him, because they're not even allowed to have the equipment you would need to make a weapon. That's just how subjugated they are. They've just been stamped down by the Philistines, who have total control over them. So the only two people in the Israelite army who are armed are Saul and Jonathan. What kind of army would it be without any kind of armor? And so when you think about that, it appears hopeless. Wouldn't you agree? Israel's cause now. I mean, how are they going to turn things around? Here you have Israel, who doesn't even have a weapon to their name, can't even sharpen or fix up their, you know, wagon and stuff without going and paying the Philistines who have total dominion over them. How are things going to change? Only through somebody finally having some faith in God, which is, of course, what Jonathan's about to do when we come to chapter 14. This is our text, really, for today, the story that we've been building up to. A new day opens in chapter 14. One day, Jonathan, the son of Saul, said to the young man who carried his armor, "Come, let us go over to the Philistine garrison on the other side." But he did not tell his father. Isn't that interesting that he didn't tell his father? Why do you suppose he didn't tell his father? Probably Saul would not have agreed with this plan. So Jonathan says to his right-hand man, "Let's go over to this Philistine garrison on the other side." Now, verse 2 says, Saul was staying in the outskirts of Gibeah in the pomegranate cave at Migron. The people who were with him were about 600 men. So he's gone from having an army of 3,000 down to 600, and they're hiding in a cave and basically just, you know, staying out of sight when Jonathan tells his armor bearer, "Come on, let's go." The next two verses kind of describe the lay of the land, verse 4 and 5. "Within the passes by which Jonathan sought to go over to the Philistine garrison, there was a rocky crag on one side, a rocky crag on the other. The name of the one was Bozes, the name of the other Senna. The one crag rose on the north in front of Michmash, and the other on the south in front of Geba." I'm not exactly sure what that looked like, but there's these two rocky prominences, and then there's a pass apparently between them. That's the lay of the land. So what could Jonathan possibly do? It's two people. It's Jonathan and his armor bearer against the army of the Philistines. Well, Jonathan realizes that there's more to it than that. Notice what verse 6. "Jonathan said to the young man who carried his armor, 'Come, let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us, for nothing can hinder the Lord from saving by many or by few.'" And there's the main passage of the lesson. Jonathan got it. Jonathan understood. Jonathan is the kind of person that God's always been looking for in his people. Somebody who realizes that really it's not about my strength. It's not about my power. It's really about God. And God's bigger than all of the enemy. And so if God chooses to, he can work through just me and you, and we can accomplish something, he's saying to his armor bearer. If this is God's plan, then God has the power to make it happen. That is the essence of faith. Notice his armor bearer's response in verse 7. "Do all that is in your heart. Do as you wish. Behold, I am with you heart and soul." Now, we need to give this young man some credit, too. I think that took a lot of faith, didn't it? This is kind of a crazy plan. I mean, crazy is probably putting it nicely. Jonathan is saying to him, "Let's go attack the enemy, just the two of us." And so he says, "I'm with you." Verse 8, Jonathan said, "Behold, we will cross over to the men and we will show ourselves to them. If they say to us, 'Wait till we come to you,' then we will stand still in our place and we will not go up to them. But if they say, 'Come up to us,' then we will go, for the Lord has given them into our hand, and this shall be the sign to us." Did you catch that? It's not much of a sign. I'm thinking if I was the armor bearer, I would say, what was the sign again? That God's with us. Think about, you remember the, Gideon's, request for a sign. He kind of kept adding on to it, right? "Well, Lord, if you mean it and you're with me, then, when I go to sleep and wake up in the morning, have the ground be wet and the fleas dry," and that worked. "Well, have the ground be dry and the fleas." He was kind of raising the bar because he needed a lot of reassurance, a lot of confidence, a lot of confirmation that this was really the plan. Jonathan's sign that he's found is, if we go up and they say, "Come on up," then we know, hey, that's the sign God's with us. Now, why do you suppose Jonathan didn't expect some bigger sign in that? I would suggest to you because Jonathan really wants to go to battle. And so he's not really asking for a huge, earth-shattering kind of sign. He's just looking for basically anything that's going to confirm this is God's plan. And again, his armor bearer is with him on this. He was expecting God's approval because he was anxious to go. Verse 11. "So both of them showed themselves to the garrison of the Philistines. And the Philistines said, 'Look, Hebrews are coming out of the holes where they've hidden themselves.' And the men of the garrison hailed Jonathan, his armor bearer, and said, 'Come up to us and we'll show you a thing.' Jonathan said to his armor bearer, 'Come up after me, for the Lord has given them into the hand of Israel.'" That's the sign. They told us to come up. So that means that it's time to go. Verse 13, I love this description. Jonathan climbed up on his hands and feet. They're just scampering up this hillside. His armor bearer after him, and they fell before Jonathan, and his armor bearer killed them after him. At that first strike, which Jonathan and his armor bearer made, killed about 20 men within, as it were, half a furrow's length in an acre of land. And there was panic in the camp, in the field, and among the people. The garrison, even the raiders, trembled, and the earth quaked, and it became a very great panic. What's happening? God's doing his thing. God showed up. So they, you know, Jonathan's hitting them once. The armor bearer's falling on behind, finishing them off. And they killed 20 people. But look at what happened as a result of that. Now the ground is shaking. This is, it takes, you know, it's a little bit more going on here than just Jonathan and his armor bearer. But that's what Jonathan knew could happen, isn't it? That if we put our faith in God, if God chooses to, he'll work through us and God can do great things. And here's God moving and doing an awesome thing. Of course, this all catches Saul by surprise. Verse 16, the watchmen of Saul in Gibeah of Benjamin looked, and behold, the multitude was dispersing here, and all the enemies running away. Then Saul said to the people who were with him, count and see who has gone out from us. And when they counted, behold, Jonathan and his armor bearer were not there. They're trying to figure out what's causing this big disturbance among the enemy. Saul doesn't seem sure what to do at first. If you keep on reading, he's trying to figure out, do we go, do we not? He's trying to seek some kind of guidance. And finally, he decides it's time to join the fight. Verse 20, then Saul and the people who were with him rallied and went into battle. Behold, every Philistine sword was against his fellow, and there was great, very great confusion. Now the Hebrews who had been with the Philistines before that time, who had gone up with them into the camp, even they also turned to be with the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. Likewise, when all the men of Israel who had hidden themselves in the hill country of Ephraim heard that the Philistines were fleeing, they too followed hard after them in battle. So the Lord saved Israel that day, and the battle pressed beyond Beth Aven. The Lord saved Israel, just as Jonathan knew he could. Now, the story goes on, but we'll stop there for now. It's kind of hard to find a stopping point sometimes in these stories. We'll stop there because we can draw some lessons from Jonathan's example of faith here. So what are some applications we can make? This is obviously a very, to me anyway, it's a very exciting story about Jonathan and his armor bearer and how just the two of them turned the whole tide of this, engagement that they had with the Philistines. So what can we learn from that for ourselves? First of all, if we compare Jonathan's faith to the complete lack of faith of the people, and we look at what is the essence of faith. What is faith really when you boil it all down? Faith has to do with things that can't be seen. The people wanted a king they could look at and they could see. They wanted something physical, something concrete that was right there in front of them, because trusting in God meant putting your faith, your confidence, your trust in something that you can't see. And then when the battle lines engaged, they're looking at the enemy, and the enemy way outnumbers them. And so if you only operate through earthly eyes and through faithless eyes, then when the enemy is much bigger than you, and when there are many more of them than there are of you, when things look that way, of course, what do? You run, hide in a cave, and you hunker down. You don't do anything because you're scared out of your mind. And that is the description of somebody who has no faith in God. Through the eyes of the flesh, we would say, well, who am I? Through the eyes of flesh, you would say, what can I do? Through the eyes of flesh, we would look at the vast number of people in the world, and then we would look at the small number of us, or even, this feels like a big number to me. Some of you are visiting here, probably from smaller congregations. Our congregation in Fayetteville is just about 60 people. And we might think, well, we're just a little church. What can we do? And even this group, compared to the vast number of people, what impact can we have? Or you and your family, or just you at work or at school. What can one person do? Through fleshly eyes, we look at those numbers and we look at who I am, and I think, I'm nobody. I'm not important. I'm not powerful. I can't really have an effect on the world, on people. I can't do anything. That's looking at things the same way the Israelites were looking at things when they were saying, we need some great leader. We need some great spokesman. We need some impressive thing. It's really easy to fall into that trap of thinking, what would really be great is if we had this, big impressive thing or some program or some person who would be a very powerful leader, and then we could probably do something. But that's not looking at things the way that Jonathan does. Jonathan understands something by faith. He trusted in God who could not be seen. And that's the same way that Moses, of course, had the courage to lead the people out of Egypt. Hebrews 11:27 says, by faith he left Egypt, not being afraid of the anger of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. So when Moses comes back to say, let my people go, now, and from a human point of view, this is a crazy plan also, to just walk right up to the king and say, we're leaving, and I want you to let us go. And, you know, how would he have the courage to do that? Hebrews tells us that he did that because he could see something bigger than the king. He could see something more powerful than the king. He could see him who is invisible. And so since Moses put his faith in someone who's more powerful than the person standing in front of him, it gave him the courage to do what was necessary. And so when we face challenges, when we face dangers, when we face things that are scary or frightening or tasks that we aren't sure about, we have to remember there's something more powerful than what we're looking at. There's something more powerful than what I can see with my eyes. There's someone who's out there who is big enough, and his power can accomplish his will the way that he chooses to. And also, through faith, through the eyes of faith, we believe in something better than this that is waiting for us. 2 Corinthians 4:17 says, this light momentary affliction is preparing us for an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison, as we look not to the things that are seen, but to the things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are transient, but the things that are unseen are eternal. So this is the essence of faith, that we understand as we face trials and difficulties and opposition and enemies, that everything that our earthly eyes can perceive and take in and look at is all passing away. And so once we realize that, these transient passing away sort of things become transparent in a sense, because we think, hey, I can see right through that. That's not real. That's not going to last forever. And then we see beyond that to things that are going to last forever, including the hope of some place that's a lot better than this, and a place of no suffering, and a place where God, you know, will be in our presence and we'll dwell with him. And once through faith we see that, then suddenly the obstacles, the things along the way become just passing, trivial trials that we have to endure in this life. That's all the way that it looks, of course, when you choose, like Jonathan did, to put your faith in God. Another thing that's interesting about faith in this application of this story is that faith trusts God and God's power even when the outcome is not known. Did you notice that Jonathan said to his armor bearer that he wasn't really sure how this was going to go? He says in verse 6, Jonathan said to the young man who carried his armor, come, let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us, for nothing can hinder the Lord from saving by many or by few. What Jonathan knows is that God has the power. What he doesn't know is God going to use this opportunity to work through us to do something? He doesn't know that. So when he sets out on this plan, he's not sure how this is going to turn out. And he says that right up front to this armor bearer. Now, it may be that God will do this. It may be that God will choose to act through us. We see this same thing over and over in the case of people who had faith. Remember Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, when they were being told, I'm going to give you one more chance. You can bow down to me, or you're going in that fiery furnace. And you remember how they responded to Nebuchadnezzar? In Daniel chapter 3, it says, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able, see, they knew God's power is there, to save us from the burning fiery furnace. And he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you've set up. They had absolute confidence in God's power. What they weren't exactly sure about, apparently, was what's about to happen. But they knew that God had power, and they're putting their faith in him regardless of the outcome. We know some people did pay the ultimate price for their faith. Sometimes people did have to die for their faith in God. But they could trust God, not knowing for sure how things were going to go. I think it's easy for us as Bible students, as we learn these stories and you see about, you know, how these people chose to have faith and face these great odds and these powerful enemies. And we would look back and we can easily put ourselves in their shoes and say, yeah, I would have been with them. I would have loved to be in that. I would have loved to have done the same thing. but we see how it all worked out. And it's hard to remember that at the moment those people were making those choices, history had not yet been written, and they didn't know how this thing is going to turn out. It's hard to put yourself in their shoes and not know the end of the story. For instance, David, when he goes to engage the giant, as we've already seen, you remember that he picked up 5 stones. Did he know that first one was going to knock him down? I don't know that he knew that. I don't know that he knew exactly how that was going to go. He might have been loading up number 2 as that one was flying through the air. He wasn't exactly sure how this was going to go, but he knew this, that God was more powerful than that giant. And so he was going to put his trust in God regardless of how this turned out. And that is really at the essence of faith, is trusting God even when I can't really see how this is going to go. So perhaps today, you know, we're considering some kind of trial that's facing us, some kind of test. And we don't know how this is going to turn out. We don't know if we're going to get a good prognosis. We don't know if this is going to turn out the way that we want it to, if things are going to work out the way we want them to. Faith is saying, I know that God is powerful. I trust in God. I'm going to follow Him even though I don't know how this is going to go. Or maybe we're thinking about doing something in service to God. I'm going to go speak to this person about this matter. I'm going to knock on my neighbor's door. I'm going to engage in a conversation with a coworker. I'm going to start a Bible study at lunchtime at work or talk to my classmate about their soul. And we, you know, in that moment, maybe you're thinking about all different ways this might go. I don't know how they're going to respond to this. I don't know if it's going to work. I don't know if it's not. But we can have Jonathan's faith to say it may be that God will use this opportunity to accomplish something. It may be this will be fruitful, that this will be something that God could use and work through to bring someone to Christ. We don't know. Faith is having the courage to step out and take action, even though I don't know exactly how this is going to turn out, because I'm trusting in God and His power and His plan. And that's exactly what Jonathan does here when he tells his armor bearer, let's go. Me and you can make a difference if God will work through us. What we can't do is fall into the trap of Saul, which was the same trap as the one talent man. And that was the trap of saying, man, it really looks scary out there. Let's just hunker down. And maybe if we can just hide in a hole somewhere, time will pass by and nobody will get hurt. Maybe I can find a good safe place where nobody can really see me and the enemy will be out there, but he won't know I'm here. And if I don't stick my head out and if I can just be quiet long enough, I can just make it through this life. That's no way to live. That's certainly no way to glorify God. That's no way for God to be able to use you to accomplish His purpose by just finding the ultimate safest route possible with no risk. That's not what God is looking for. In fact, that's a sort of a cowardly way out, isn't it? I mean, when you see Israel's army hiding in caves and cisterns and holes and really crossing the fords of the Jordan, and did you notice in the story, some of them had even gone over to join the Philistines? They had even turned over to the side of the enemy. That's cowardice. That's saying, hey, this whole enemy thing is way too frightening for me. And so I don't really want to get hurt. I don't want to be embarrassed. I don't want to put anything on the line here. I'm going to play it safe. And that's what Saul did. And that is the response that people have when they have no faith in God. Of course, when we see what the results are of having faith and choosing the type of course of action that Jonathan did, we see these two results of faith. It glorifies God and it encourages others. Notice that God was glorified through this. God was there all along. And, you must wonder what this looks like from God's perspective. His people being just totally overrun by the enemy, hiding, running, having to pay to have them sharpen their axe and all those things. It didn't have to be that way. This was the way it was because nobody there had any faith. And so this is just the way it's going to be. God's ready at any moment in that story, I'm convinced, to step in and turn the tide. But what he was waiting for was somebody to put faith in him and to trust in him and to act by that faith. And until somebody did that, things were going to be bad for the people. And so God's just sort of there, and he's waiting for someone to choose to have faith in him. And when they do, we see that God is glorified because God works through them, and God then, gives this great, awesome victory, and all the credit and the glory goes to God. And notice how other people were inspired by this choice of Jonathan's. It starts with, let's just follow the chain of events. It starts with one person. Jonathan says, It starts with Jonathan. He trusts in God. And then he says to his armor bearer, hey, let's go. Me and you, we're going to go over there. And it may be that God will work with us because God's God and he can do that. And his armor bearer says in verse 7 of chapter 14, do all that is in your heart. Do as you wish. Behold, I am with you heart and soul. What a great friend. Everybody needs somebody like that, don't they? Everybody needs that guy who is saying, you know what? I'm with you. I'm with you. I like this plan. It's a good idea. And I'm backing you up and I'm right there. I'm right there with you. Let's go do it. And, you know, not everybody is a Jonathan kind of a leader, but everybody can be this kind of supportive. Yes, this is a good plan and I'm with you. Heart and soul. Me and you, we're going to do this thing. So it starts out with Jonathan, and then he encourages his armor bearer, who's now having faith as well and acting on that faith. And then as you see how this bubbles over by the end of the day, it's the rest of the army. They're crawling out of their holes. The faithless King Saul himself is joining the battle finally. And in fact, the Israelites who had defected to the Philistine army turn on the enemy. So by the end of the day, the entire Israelite group of men who's fighting are now joining the battle, and it all trace it back. It all goes back to this decision by one man to say, hey, we can do this because God is on our side. And so what a powerful example for us. What can you do? What can I do? What can one person do? What can two people do? What can you and a friend accomplish? Well, if we look at it through human eyes and you know, you lay out the odds, really probably not very much. From just a human point of view, how can you affect the world? How can any one of us affect the world or affect people or have any kind of impact? Probably not very much on a human level if you look at it through the eyes of flesh. But when you look at it through the eyes of faith like Jonathan and you say, hey, God's powerful. God has a powerful plan and God has big plans. And what could God do through me if I will just have faith in him and act on that faith? What could God accomplish and what could he use you? And then think about the people who, when they choose to do that, how that spreads and encourages a bigger group of people when they see one person who speaks up. And so could you be that person who says, I'm going to do something. And then there's others that see you doing it and they're encouraged. Could you be the one who is willing to speak out about the truth and to say what you know is right? Or the one person who's willing to take a stand on something when nobody else has the courage to speak up? You see these videos sometimes where some awful thing's happening and there's just a group of people in the background. Nobody's doing anything or saying anything. Nobody wants to get involved. But could you be that person who's willing to say, hey, this isn't right? Or to stand up, to put your faith in God, to say, I'm going to do the right thing and I'm going to trust God that he's powerful enough to make all this work out. Can you face the enemies of sin and doubt by faith, by focusing on the unseen God who is more powerful than all of us, more powerful than all of our enemies? Perhaps this very evening there's someone here who is ready to put your faith in God and take a step of faith, a step out, perhaps even just literally into the aisle. I know that can be a frightening thing when that's on someone's heart and that your heart is pounding and you're considering, do I or do I not? It boils down to having faith like Jonathan and saying, you know what? I'm going to trust in God. I know he's there. I know he's real. I know he can work. I know he can save me. And then maybe he can work through you to help others. If there's someone tonight who needs to put on Christ in baptism, or if there's someone who needs to be restored to the Lord and we can pray for you and with you, we'd be glad to do that if you'll let us know as we stand and sing.